Thank you. Good morning all. So this talk is going to be mostly about observation, laboratory work, and field work. This is where I work. This is who my employer is. This work, however, was done in Rennes with Alexandre Valence. This is lab work. This is field work that I intend to do now in Brest. And this is field work that was done in Switzerland at the VAPFL Lausanne in a postdoc before I moved to Brest. So the first part of the talk is going to be about laboratory experiments. The actual lab work was done by Julie Dreano during her PhD thesis and her first level of analysis, which I will walk you through. And then I came in for a postdoc with a different approach to look at the data. So we're going to start with a little bit of motivation, talk about the result from the 1D analysis, and then the result from a more 2D analysis. So we're looking at bed forms in the fluvial context. The control parameters are the flow rate, the sediment flow rate, water flow rate, bed type, that is morphology, and diameter of grains. What you can one can notice is that there's a large range of bed form sizes, shapes, and types. So I've shown a few examples here. This is ripples at the foot of a glacier in a dry stream bed. This is much larger dunes. And this is what examples of what we're going to see from the lab work, which are called bed load sheets that are just a front of a sheet of sand moving forward. And there's textbooks classification that explain you how ripples go from ripples or dunes go from 2D features to 3D bed forms with sinuosity and irregularity in the shapes of the crest line. So we're looking at those three interacting processes. How flow is going to entrain grain and destabilize the interface, and bed forms created in return are going to affect the flow and are going to affect transport. So we're looking at shear flow. There's been, of course, a lot of work done on erodible and non-erodible beds that have shown that there's a growth phase where the bed form evolves and matures until it reaches saturation of the morphological parameters. And it's also been shown that the final stage depends on the sediment supply. So in our case, we're going to control supply of solids. So the questions are mechanisms responsible for selecting the wavelengths, and in general, the morphological parameters, and whether given a snapshot of the bed forms, whether we can invert for the flow conditions that were prevailing when the bed forms were created. So we have three parameters controlling the experiments. That's the sediment inflow. We'll show after how it's controlled. The friction velocity of the flow, which tells us about the flow rate, basically, and grain size. The idea is to run a lot of experiments with changing those three parameters and look at the different morphological types we obtain, classify them, and try to extract the influence of the different parameters on the platform development. And in the end, it's to come up with parallels to see if we can get any relationship that work across the entire domain of parameters. So this is the experimental setup. It's a closed duct, so there's no free surface. This is about 12 centimeters wide, and the water depth is about 37 millimeters. There is a system here that is basically a little lift driven by a computer-controlled motor that will raise the box of sand, basically glass beads, into the flow, and the sand and the flow erodes the sand, and that's how you control the inputs. So you have a steady rate, or rather steady rate of sediment input into your flume, and then the bed forms are going to develop in this area here. And there's a camera and a video projector that's projecting fringe patterns and analyzing the images you can extract for the bathymetry. What else can I say? The little spikes here are made to break the formation of bed forms on the supply system. Otherwise, you would have a pulsed input as the bed form migrate across the box and reach the downstream part of the flume. What else? This is the type of the range of parameters we're looking at. There's only two different grain sizes. The Rouse number tells us that with the smaller grain sizes, we have both suspension and bed load transport. With the larger grains, we mostly have bed load. What else is there here? The friction velocity was evaluated using a PIV on a flat bed, so it's not measuring the velocity profile over the dunes once they've created. It's really an indication of the flow forcing, so really the flow rate before the bed forms are created. And this is indications on the resolution of the data acquisition system. So that's the type of bed forms that are created. This is with small grains. So the grains are transported into the working area first by suspension, and patterns start to form until you get to an organized set of bed forms. I think this could be a good time to show a video if they want to work. So the software doesn't play at a constant rate necessarily, so it seems it does accelerate as you go. But so this is small grain size and rather low supply, and you see dunes that we're gonna call barkings.
Do we have to know the rate of supply in order to understand these videos? That is, do you have barkings when there's a limited supply of grain?
I'll show you a phase diagram after. You don't need to know what the conditions are to understand the videos, but you get different outputs depending on the forcing conditions. So this is something that we would qualify more as a transverse dune. So they're not really steady. There's a side effects, and they evolve over time, but on average...
Do they become more three-dimensional over time in your experiment?
So the experiments were running for about an hour and a half, and I think that the ones that become 3D, you'll see it right away. That's going to be one example now, in fact.
Nick, we have to ask the question. Are these dunes or ripples?
Oh. I know.
So this is more what I would call three-dimensional or lingucoid bed forms. So ripples or dunes, I think, I mean, I would call them dunes. I'd call them dunes. Now, we don't have a good, we don't know about the free surface interaction because we don't have one. We definitely see coarsening pattern, so we're not looking at the first order instability that arises right after the input. If we were, right here, right after the box, you would perhaps see the linear response, but in this zone here, and after like the for the period that we are considering, the I think we have a lot of nonlinear effects basically that come into play. So this is the mature bed form stage. So I don't know if we would run the experiment for hours and hours. I don't know how that would change. I don't know whether they would grow higher. I assume not, because the water depths would limit.
What makes you tell that there are nonlinear effects there? The amplitude is big with the threats on some scale, so that will make nonlinearity important, or? What is it making you say that nonlinear effects are important?
I think there's some lateral variability. You can see that some of the bed forms catch up with the one ahead. Okay. So there's merging, and some will split. You have singularities that appear.
Is it possible that you just have a competition between different wavelengths? So one is trying to emerge, and then you see different thinking, the transient. Because nonlinearity should involve a big amplitude. So if the point is that the amplitude of the bed forms is big with respect to some scale, then I will tell you, I will agree with you, okay? But what I was thinking is that usually to have a linear response is just enough to have a very small perturbation, right? But you can have many different wavelengths that are unstable at the same time.
I think so. From looking at the movies, I think we can look at this one again. For example, I think that the wavelength emerges before you see this splitting and merging behavior.
I mean, the amplitude looks very saturated, right? Doesn't it look like they keep growing? So that suggests one linear effect as well.
Yeah. Other saturation, yeah.
If you made this longer, I mean, would these forms, when they look as though they're propagating out of your domain, so, I mean, if you had a
longer domain
that was 10 times longer, would you expect them to be different at the end, or are they already on this landscape?
I think they would not evolve further.
Yeah. They just propagate.
Yeah. The temporal evolution shows that the wavelengths and height saturate quite rapidly and they reach steady states on average.
Do you know why it's selecting it?
Well, we can see later some of the parameters that influence the transport and the shape that we obtain at the end. The wavelength is certainly related somewhat to the water depths that we have. And these are the bed load sheets where you can see suspended transport is very little, so you don't have your zone first covered by grains and then they arrange into a pattern. You really see a front that's prograding into the viewing zone, and you see those sheets that have almost 100% coverage of the bed, and they're highly three-dimensional there, have a very flat top.
This is with the coarser sediment?
Yeah. 500? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So this is the different types of steady states bed forms we obtain. So in all, I think Julie made a total of like 46 different runs, and in all runs, so varying those different parameters, there's only two grain sizes, but a range of sediment input rate and flow forcing, you always obtain a equilibrium situation. And this is the four types of dunes you can observe. And for the fine grains, you don't have bed load sheets. And for the larger grains, you don't have hurricanes. So temporal evolutions. So Julie had been looking at parameters like wavelengths, migration speed, the lengths and the amplitude of the dune, the maximum or mean height. This is all these examples show one case with 100 microns, and you see the growth phase and then saturation for all of the different parameters, height, maximum height, the mean height, migration speed, and the wavelengths. And as I was mentioning earlier, the wavelength sort of scales like the water depths. Not shown here, 500 microns, but you don't have this growth phase because you don't really see it. You see the fronts arriving already mature morphology. The fluctuations that you see here are just a signature of the refills of the sediment loading box. So there's two different regimes that show up when you have a low solid input. This is what limits the morphologies that you observe. So this is the diagram showing height in the steady state versus input rate. So this would be this phase here, where you see that if you provide more, your bed form will be higher. And at high input, you reach the saturated regime here, where your bed form is then limited by the geometry of your setup, basically. So you've of your setup and of the flow conditions. So you've reached the transport capacity of the flow, and the rest of the input will just be carried as suspension over the bed forms.
If I read this right, then your bed load sheets for a given sediment input are higher than the ones in the 100 millimeter, sorry, 100 micron beam. Is that correct?
In terms of the amplitude.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And why is that?
It may be higher in terms of millimeter, but not some of them, diameter.
Some of them are
right, yeah.
Are not. I mean, there's also sinusoidal dunes, lingoid dunes that probably get close to as high as the bed load sheets. I would say they're not necessarily systematically higher than the other bed forms. The barkanes are definitely shorter, they correspond to low transport rates, low inputs. Julie did try changing a little bit the water depths, and for those three runs, nothing else changing. You don't really see a very strong signature, but then the changes in water height are not very significant to really be able to test that. For the coarse grain, the saturated regime, that is when you reach the transport capacity of the flow, is not really reached. No, maybe this point here, but definitely not here. So presumably you could get even larger bed forms.
So what are the differences between sets 1, 2, 3 or 4, 5, 6?
They correspond to different flow rates, water flow rates. Mm-hmm. When trying to compare the morphology obtained with the forcing condition, one interesting product that came up was the product of the migration speed with the bed form height. So remember that normally you expect bed load only for the coarser grains because of the Rouse number, and bed load and suspension for the finer grains. So the coarser grains are the colored triangles here. And really, when you plot these products, you recover everything that you put in, essentially. That's this line there. Whether for the finer grains, rapidly this product becomes a lot less than what your sediment input rate is. That's because a lot of the transport is suspension transport and does not contribute as much as the bed load to the morphology of the ripples. So for the fine grains, this QC, the which is basically the flux that is transported with the dunes, saturates quickly as you increase the inflow. Solid inflow and suspension is where all the rest of the input goes, and that's what dominates. And for the coarser grain size, this is essentially the same as the input, and there's very little going as suspension. So that kind of that type of analysis pushed us to use this as a relevant flow rate to sort of compare coarse and fine grains.
When you say suspension, you simply mean transport that is not within the dune. Is that right? You mean turbulent suspension, or is it both bed load and turbulent suspension that's involved in what you call suspension?
Suspension, I mean the typical understanding of transport with the flow, with the turbulence, as opposed to
wash load, so something that is washed away and does not interact anymore with the bed?
Probably very little.
Is it bypassing? Is it going right out the other end of the flow?
On the previous slide, it looked to me like the saturation of sediment flux was about maybe the same for, roughly the same for all the flow rates.
You mean around
about
here?
About 60, 70 times 10 to the minus 10. Is that something that you have observed generally, or is that just due to the limitations of the apparatus? I mean, some points, for instance, the black triangles do not extend to higher sediment rates, so it is perhaps a little hard to...
I think that for this data set and this one, the saturation would come later. So I don't think this value here comes from the setup. I think it's governed by grain size and flow rate.
I mean, the saturation, you would say that the saturation sediment flux, sediment flux at saturation would depend on the flow rate.
For the set 2, for example, you're more around here. For set 3, more around here. So I think they don't all fall exactly on the same range of sediment inflow. This three-phase diagram represent the function of water flow rate and sediment flow rate, what type of bed form you get for each of the two grain sizes. So Barkhans transverse and Lingoid dunes for the fine grains, and transverse to bedload sheets for the coarser grains. So you don't see a lot of Barkhans. You see mostly transverse dunes and a little bit of Lingoid dunes. And for the coarser grains, you see mostly those Lingoid 3D dunes. You see a little bit of bedload sheets at really high sediment flow rate, and at very low sediment input, you see transverse dunes. And this is compiling everything with this flux transported with the dunes, which allows looking at all the data on the same plot, except that it will sort of collapse the fine grain region here.
Excuse me. Can you give us some figure on what the shear stress is in this experiment?
It will
come later on.
It came a bit earlier. We didn't mention much, but
okay, probably I missed that.
We don't talk about it. That's the range you get compared to the critical shear stress. So you're way above the critical shear stress for the fine grain, and you're a little bit above for the coarse grains. Okay, and this is the kind of power law that were obtained by Julie. So this is only for the coarse grains, 500 microns, and here we're plotting this flux that's transported with the dune, and here we're looking at the velocity of the dunes rescaled by the friction velocity, and that's optimal fit for the to show that the exponent 3 is a little better than the rest. So this scaling is not necessarily what you'd expect, and we don't have an explanation for that available. It applies to bed forms of different shapes for the coarse fraction, but it doesn't work that well for the fine fraction, which is what is shown here. It's this data set particularly that doesn't work too well. This one works a little better.
Friction velocity to the third power means she has to have three pounds, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Is your poor fit for the smaller particles because the sediment is bypassing the fluid?
So yeah, it's because there's different transport modes.
Yeah.
So that's probably why it doesn't work.
Did you try to put it in dimensionless form? So in the particle diameter.
I think she's tried rescaling by particle diameter, but I don't think. I'm not sure, actually, she's tried that. Maybe not.
It's strange that all the plots are given in dimensionless terms, or dimensional terms. And gravity and diameter are natural ways to scale the data.
Yeah, I don't know, perhaps that would help. The rescaling here, but but I mean, nowhere here we plot as a function of grain size though, so I don't know where the rescaling with grain size would come in.
It might be interesting to see the plot in the upper right-hand corner that involves, you know, beads of both diameters expressed in a more natural measure of length, like particle diameter. And also, it's difficult to interpret what you mean by the nth power of the friction velocity. You get involved in some very strange dimensions there.
Well, this is the third.
Yeah, I
power here.
Yeah, I understand. But it looks like you've tested many.
Yeah, I mean, basically, there was, like, the fit that comes out is not necessarily satisfactory. And the third power is what gives the best.
So have you tried to compare this velocity with the wavelength of your patterns or other dimensions of the structures?
Yeah, so I think that there's different combinations that you can do using the amplitude, the wavelength, the velocity of the dunes, and you get formulas like that are not independent from each other, because this flux, for example, depends on the bed form amplitude.
Could you tell me again what QC stands for?
That's the migration velocity multiplied by the bed form height.
essentially the volume flow rate carried
yes.
by a, the dune.
Yeah.
But am I wrong if I say that this velocity is something that gives you the amount of sediment that moves with the bed front?
Yeah.
And aren't you there comparing there this with the let's say the equilibrium discharge or something like that? I mean the sediment discharge, let's say on a flatbed, the one that is associated not with the bed front movement, with the sediment transfer.
So
sediment doesn't move only because of the
So in the coarse grains case,
uh-huh.
they're pretty much the same.
Okay.
And in the fine grains, they're not. You're missing all the wash load.
Can I bring one other thing up? You're correlating, part of the correlation is the V dune versus the V dune, isn't it?
Yeah, that's.
So you're correlating.
Yeah. Here,
kind of
yeah, in here, yeah, the this the number unit. Here, I mean, this volume that's carried by the dunes depends on I mean, it's expressed as a function of V dunes. So it's not that it's spurious, it's that there's those three like V dune, the friction velocity, and the height of the dune. Mm-hmm. So there's two morphological parameters of the dune, and one of the input, basically, of the experiment. So this is what this is saying, basically. And you could turn it different ways. You could express the equilibrium height as a function of the friction velocity and this flux, which also depends on the equilibrium heights. So there is one correlation that works more or less, that works rather well for the 500 microns, that relates the flow rate to the morphological parameters.
What about Shields parameter versus dune flux? Mm-hmm.
So that would be where the normalization with the grain size would,
pardon me?
That would be where the normalization with the grain size would come in.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if you tried that or not.
Can we show that the gene flux in the case of the coarse grain is more or less than the bed load mass transport for given shear stress? In case of coarse grain, this quantity Qc is more or less the maximum capacity of the flow given the shear stress.
Yeah, but it's, yeah, I don't know if you could do the same to, because in the fine grain, it's also the maximum transport capacity of the flow. And it doesn't scale the same way. And maybe taking into account grain size would help the fit here.
So you start with the friction velocity without...
without dunes. You could get one, yeah. It's more difficult to measure because the dunes migrate. You could measure them on fixed dunes, I would say, model dunes.
Maybe it's still a question, but I'm a bit confused now. What was the motivation to come up with these plots? Was it just by accident or?
No, those plots, they're trying to correlate the input parameter to the morphological parameters.
But you have many morphology parameters, don't you?
Like, well, you have the migration velocity, the heights, the wavelengths.
My question is, why do you choose it in such a way where I don't see anything?
Why do I choose it in such a way? Like, the other, like, what else would you have wanted to see?
A typical plot would be migration velocity versus 1 over ripple length or tune length.
Yeah, so, yeah, but then you're only looking at morphological parameters within each other. The idea here is to relate them to the flow, to the input parameters. Not looking at the geometry itself, how the height relates to the aspect ratio or things like that. You're trying to looking at the morphology, see if you can invert for what's the relation to the forcing condition.
This QC is not an input parameter, is it? For the
so QC, it is for the coarse grain.
Yeah. But if you have this wash load,
then it's not. Which is why it works well here, and it works not as well on top.
Did you monitor the amount of suspended sediment leaving the waves
that No, they didn't weigh the wash load as it got trapped.
But suppose you were to plot some heat equilibrium divided by the square root of QC. Then QC is essentially that is given by your morphological parameters V equilibrium as well.
Yeah.
And so we would have everything that is more
on one side.
And then
yeah, maybe that's a better presentation. Yeah. You would have square root of V divided by square root of H.
So V over H would just be like U star to the sixth power.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I think it's a quite strong statement. And,
yes, except it's not.
Yeah.
We don't have a way to explain this. It's not. It is a strong statement because and there you put everything on the same side.
Yeah. I think then this would get the theorists to think about it. Because 6 power is quite a lot.
Yeah, this is what's not. Cool. Okay, so the motivation now to go from this 1D analysis where you look at a cross section and you look at the amplitude and the wavelengths to, because we have a digital elevation model, so we could probably extract more information out of those bed forms. And for example, take into account the span-wise variability in the morphology and parameters like sinuosity, which we've seen is important to distinguish transverse from those lingoid bed forms. So the approach is to use segmentation by applying a threshold to the symmetry. And then we analyze the resulting binary images and trying to come up with morphological parameter that will discriminate the different steady state morphologies that we obtain. And eventually, if you can identify objects that we haven't done that yet in that case, but you could possibly track them. And parameters that are discriminant for the morphological characters, but that also make sense or could make sense in terms of physical forcing. So this is how we go. This is the grayscale image of the dune in each of the four cases. I took one example. Normalized by the maximum height in the current frame, and you you cut a certain height, and you decide which one is bed form and which one is inter bed form space. And these threshold here, they're the threshold that will minimize the intra-class variance between the pixels that are considered within the bed form and the pixels that are considered outside of the bed form. That's one way to determine threshold, and we've tried to see how that choice was affecting the results we got.
You mean inside the bed form and outside the bed form? Once again.
So if you have topography, you take a horizontal cut, and what is above, basically, will cut the limit of what is inside, and what is below will be the limit of what is considered non-bed form.
Okay, but let's create, I mean, it's just crest and trough, right?
Yes.
It's just crest and trough.
Because if outside you cut it in the middle, it's outside, it's a crest.
Yeah.
Okay.
But depending on where you cut, you're going to have a little.
Say half the way?
Yeah. Well, we'll see how that.
What does lingoid mean?
It means that it's a sinuous, okay. in a way, that it's okay. Three dimensional. Uh-huh. It's kind of when it has like this cuspate shape. So after we've identified bed forms, we can isolate each of them and compute certain parameters, starting by some very obvious things like how many we have. Sinuosity was determined by the sum of the downstream and upstream contour divided by twice the span. The area ratio of the space occupied by the bed forms to the full image. And now we're going to try to see how those properties depend on the threshold that we choose, and if there's a if it changes a lot, which threshold we pick. So here you're looking at each color is one different bed form type that I picked out of all the configurations that were tried. This is the count of bed form, and this is the threshold. So basically, you move your horizontal cut level up from 0 to 1 on your normalized grayscale image. Solid line is your mean, because so there's a each run is a series of different images that you saw when you play the movie, and the count will change from one image to the next, essentially. So that's what gives you this standard deviation here. And this square here corresponds to this optimal threshold. That's the minimum of the intra-class variance that also has a standard deviation in terms of bed form count, but it has a standard deviation in terms of the threshold itself, because since it's not fixed, it will change from one image to the next. So for a given run, as you process all of the images, you're not necessarily going to see the same threshold value. So what this tells us, for example, is that bed form count, I mean, of course, I took four very distinct bed form types, but this bed form count parameter allows you to discriminate the different morphologies, and that the optimal choice here sort of corresponds to a portion where the bed form count doesn't vary too abruptly in the threshold you choose. That is, we don't want to work in this area here. We don't want to work in this area here. It's better to work here, sort of, between 03 and 06 or 05.
If you are just looking at one standard deviation, I would think that the best might be somewhere 0.37, because then you can distinguish, you don't have overlap between those the different best ones.
So somewhere here.
Yeah.
Which
if
is.
If you go to 0.5, then the green and the red overlap.
Yeah. So which means basically, if you take a value around between 03 and 04, you'd be okay. But as you will see for other parameters for the bed load sheet, because they have a much higher coverage, basically, you need to move your threshold higher to identify identify the bed forms. So this is why it makes sense to not necessarily have a fixed threshold and just let the morphology dictate what is the optimum threshold for the image.
Is this a measure of the shape, the relative kind of triangularity of these bed forms?
Yeah.
Essentially, if they were perfectly triangular, it would be around 0.5, right?
Yeah.
They're not. They're kind of hump shaped. Is that correct?
I'm not showing that here. Well, there's another parameter, so I'll skip this slide here. But this slide, the area ratio.
Yeah.
So okay. How much of the bed form, how much of your images is covered by bed form? This is sort of an inverted cumulated probability density function the shape of this curve will tell you about the symmetry or the shape of the bed forms. Here you can notice one interesting thing is that the optimal choice for the threshold yields a significantly smaller standard deviation than if you take a fixed threshold. That's also one thing that makes it interesting to use this optimal threshold. And you see that the optimal threshold is not the same for all bed form types either, and you have the same progression from Barkheim transverse to the bed load sheets. I'm going to move back to this one, which is sinuosity. So that's the whole plot, basically. And it tells you that when you have very low threshold, this parameter is not very meaningful, basically. And it only starts to make sense when you have a higher threshold, and especially for your bed load sheets, you absolutely need to be in this 0.5 or higher range, because at the beginning, basically, you're seeing a single bed form, and it makes no sense to compute sinuosity on that. There's also a problem with this particular parameter. As the bed forms migrate across your images, when you don't have a lot of them, when they're going to be truncated, you're going to affect a lot the measurements. So you would need to manually look at images where your bed load sheets is right in the middle of your image, so you have both the upstream and the downstream end. So the conclusion of those three slides would be that this optimal choice is probably a good idea, a good way to go, as opposed to setting a fixed threshold, mostly because of the difference in the height of the bed forms and the coverage. There. Bed load sheet being extremely different compared to the other ones. Two slides on the temporal evolution of those parameters, so the bed form count, the area ratio, sinuosity, and threshold, that is, if you don't take the optimal threshold, but if you, if you take the optimal threshold, how this one varies over time. So this is for a transverse dune, 100 micron grain size. You can see that you have the same expected behavior of a growth phase followed by a saturation of the bed form. So this is your bed form growing, and this is your saturation level, and you probably see the signature of the resupply from the sediment box. You see that sinuosity is probably more sensitive than the other parameters, and it's sensitive to the stability of the bed forms. In the movies that we've seen, there's some stages where you really have the nice transverse shape, and then when there's one that catches up with the other, it kind of messes up the entire pattern. And if you have two or three out of your seven bed form across the images that change property, you'll have a large effect on the sinuosity. So this was for one run. Here I'm showing four different morphologies. So here again, the one that's the more jagged is the bed load sheet, but really this is the front arriving. So you really want to start looking at the equilibrium stage. That is when your front has covered your entire field of view after 4,000 seconds. So that's about here. So you still see variability, and that is because bed load sheets, you have two or three per field of view, and when they enter and leave the field of view, you get those spurious values here. But other than that, the bed form count is rather stable, and even the threshold is rather stable across the image. I think that's what I'm showing here. And now, again, we're trying to relate the morphological parameters. So here, the new parameters based on our 2D analysis with the flow parameters. And in this case, this, which is the input rate for the 500 microns and for the 100 microns, just the load that's transported with the bed forms. So here we have a fit that works rather well, although you don't span a lot of range in sinuosity. So this log-log plot is a little biased. But still, it means that there is relevance in trying to interpret sinuosity of those bed forms in terms of the forcing conditions. That is, there is a reason why for a given flow rate or input rate of sediment, you get bed forms that are going to be more or less 3D, basically. And sinuosity does adjust to the forcing conditions. And something that it could be related to could be the fact that when you have sinuosity, it probably means that you don't only have streamwise transport, but you also probably have transport in the lateral direction, and you probably affect the local hydrodynamic condition differently when you have an obstacle that's spanwise uniform, as opposed to when you have variability in when the flow is going to decelerate or accelerate as it sees the bed form crest at a different streamwise distance.
Perhaps I missed this, but what's the rationale for the QC divided by U star Q? Why did you choose that parameter?
So here, this is we tried different power for those two parameters, and this is the one that seems to give the best fit.
So how does QC look as a function of U star like?
I'm sorry?
QC versus U star, how does it look like? So if this other U star.
So for the 500 microns, it's they're not related. They're that's the experiment conditions. Right, that's just your control parameters. For the 500 microns, QC is just like QIN, so that's the control, and U star is also control. For the 100 microns, because the transport capacity depends on U star, certainly QC depends on U star.
How wide was your channel again?
12 centimeters, the width.
So something like four times the water depth.
Three or four times, yeah, a little bit more than three times.
Are you reasonably sure that the sinuosity is not strongly affected by...
By the width that causes friction, and that's going to slow down certain bed forms, but it I mean, in the way that it is computed, no. But in the emergence of sinuosity in the bed form, yeah, you probably have some effects of the wall that will slow down the lateral packets. But it's not, looking at the videos, it's not the only origin for sinuosity. You're gonna see sinuosity appearing right in the middle of your channel, and in the barkens, which are sinuous, they don't span the entire width, and you still have sinuous bed forms. Another scaling was with the bed form count that we transform in bed form density by normalizing by the area of the image, and there we find, so the same, we tried different powers here, and the scaling we obtain in the end is the same actually, which means that the bed form density and the sinuosity are related, they're not independent, at least in this data set. So the bed form density for transverse bed form, it's related to the wavelengths. For the barkens, it's related to how they're staggered, and that allows essentially counting how many you have across your field of view. And for the more 3D bed form, it's related to the continuous character as they deform and become sinusoidal, how soon do they break up into different bed forms. So it's perhaps telling us something about this coarsening process when bed forms split into smaller ones, or when they merge. And when you put those two parameters together, this is not log-log anymore. And you get this scaling between sinuosity and bed form density. That works rather well. So there you don't have, that's all the different runs, regardless of the grain size, flow rates, and sediment input rates. And that pair of parameters seems to be efficient to discriminate the different bed form types. That is, instead of visually classifying the bed form types, now we can rely on this automated estimation to set those bounds here.
Well, 22.4 is a dimensional quantity.
Mm-hmm.
What is the length scale that governs this quantity?
So this is perhaps going to be affected by how big your images are. Like there's clearly some size effect there with the size of the field of view. But yeah, this where this power comes from and where this constant comes from, I'm not sure.
The bed quorum density is not exactly sure what that is. It's the number of bed quorums.
So count divided by the area. So you
number of bed quorums per area. Per
yeah.
Area.
Which you know, like this is in metric unit, but you could you could get a different unit for your area, and you could change the scale here. So you change the constant.
So the sinuosity involves the length of the contour, right?
So it's the sum of the upstream and downstream contour lengths divided by the span.
This scaling doesn't just show you that there is a link between the length of the contour and the area of the black hole. So that's why you have this scaling. So I don't know, doesn't look like a spurious correlation again?
Between the length
and the area.
Well, the sinuosity is scaled by the span-wise, by the span of the bed forms. So it's
into the 22.4.
Well, yeah, this is basically saying that the area scales with the length squared.
Yeah.
But your lengths is scaled here by the it's not the extent of the bed form, it's how you deviate from a straight downstream and upstream front. So you, regardless of your bed form size or area, it's how the contour is convoluted or not.
This relationship suggests that that measure of that is proportional to the area.
Sure. Yep.
If we keep the same area covered, but make the base forms much, much smaller, the sinuosity should remain the same.
So that's if you move your where you put your horizontal cut basically. You would if you move it up, you would reduce the area of the bed form.
But the sinuosity would not change thereby.
It should not change.
Then we're saying that this curve would depend very much on where you put the threshold.
So if the sinuosity doesn't change as you move the threshold, the bed form density doesn't change either, depending on where you put the threshold. This is how many bed forms you have resized by the area of your field of view. Okay. some perspectives quickly on the need to have the same experiment with a free surface to see how that affects the saturation of the morphology. Try to see how that compares to data in the field or in other settings. Trying to see how the parameters that we've extracted, like sinuosity, for example, how they relate to the hydrodynamics. And there's in that direction of looking for morphological parameters to exploit the to better exploit the DEMs, there's more things, because now we're not looking at 3D objects, we're just looking at 2D cuts. So it's a little better than just a typical wave analysis where you extract wavelengths and height, but there's a lot more to the morphology of those platforms, basically. I don't know about this time. I'll go quickly on this some field data that is more the things that I'm going to be doing in where I'm staying in Brest now. So they're more interested in marine environments. And in particular, there's this large bedform field just off the coast of Brittany with a large sand banks or depot center that's giving out dunes migrating this way, and some other migrating this way, and some coming from offshore coming in at an angle here. So some information about this dune field. So this is the tip of Brittany here. You see fairly large dunes up to kilometer wavelengths up to 30 meters height here, and you see fairly large migration rates. The net inflow or outflow outside of this whole field of dune is almost zero, which would mean that there's some kind of an equilibrium condition with outgoing flow and incoming flow of solids, which would mean that perhaps this is a system that's in equilibrium. To be noticed that the large dunes are about up to one third of the water depths here. You're within 70 to 100 meter water. The forcing, you have a very peculiar situation with an embayment here between the coastline and the archipelago and the island here that's looking north. There's one seal at about 70 meters here and another seal that's 15 meters right here. So you basically channel all of the tidal currents from the channel, so you get pretty strong flow and pretty complicated current patterns that kind of rotate in here, and you do get different currents in this location going along the coast northeast, and you have this reverse in the flow basically. There's also an interesting part to this field site, which is that during the last transgression, that's when this depot center was formed, basically, when all this was actually a bay and the continent would extend across the islands. And the deposit was formed of is formed of bioclasts, so it's basically organism shells. So it's mineral. It's about 1 millimeter grain size and rather not very well rounded, I'll say. And the fact that those different seals have opened at different times have given rise to different current forcing, basically, and you can date that in the stratigraphy of the dunes, where you can invert for past migration behavior. So this is the setting. These are some examples of the types of dunes that you find. So this is a asymmetric dune. This is some dunes that are highly sinusoidal. Here you have something that could look like Barkan dunes, and you also have completely symmetric trochoidal, in this case, dunes. So you have a large variety of shapes. So provided that we could get a better access to the hydrodynamic condition at different location on this field of dune, that gives us a good site to sample the relationship between forcing condition and the resulting morphology. The first result that came out of the morphological analysis is this relationship that you were referring to between the height and the wavelengths, and the data of the Banc du Four. There is a regression, but that's not corresponding to what has been found in prior literature studies. And also some of the dunes in terms of height exceed the what is typically recognized as a maximum bound for dune heights. And the other parameters, like if you involve the asymmetry and the migration rate, you don't really find a good scaling relationship. So depending on whether we can get funding, basically, we've planned some work to focus on a few dunes and get the symmetry, velocity, and concentration to measure transport locally, and try to see how that relates to the 4D dynamics of the dune field. That is, if you do bathymetry at different points in time. So there's already three different bathymetries that were acquired and going every year or twice a year. You could get a snapshot of the evolution of the entire dune field. And I'll take the remaining 10 minutes to switch topics a little bit and go to a different environment. That's the bottom of Lake Geneva. So this is work during a postdoc at a PFL with a large group that took part in this project LMO that was about the exploration of the Geneva Lake. So I'll start with the context of the work. This is maybe on a timer, actually. That's why it's moving fast. Anyways, so this is Lake Geneva. Between the Juras and the Alps. So the lake is up to 300 meter deep. The main flow is on the Rhone that has formed a large, I'm gonna go back, a large prograding delta. The one comes in here and comes out here. The main forcing for the currents is the wind that creates surface shear, and that will also drive internal waves. This LMO project was basically around the use of the Russian subs that were made available to the institute. And the objective was to get a snapshot of the ecosystem, and the idea being to understand how the ecosystem operates, how pollutants are transported throughout the lake into the sea floor, the lake floor, and monitor how this reserve of fresh water would adjust to global change. One part of the project was to look at bed forms that have been observed 50 years ago, that are those pillow rounded like structures that are not readily explained, and that are important for all the benthic processes of bacterial transformation of the chemical environment at the lake bottom. So this is about half a meter to 1 meter horizontal and 20 centimeters in height. So part of the work was to, so this map shows the tracks of the subs, and after referencing all of the dives, you have here the dive profile, you have where videos was acquired, and you can look at the video record and label it with different bed form types from a classification that was designed prior to doing this systematic analysis. And another set of data, in addition to the video observation, was stereographic data from two cameras that were looking down that allows you to reconstruct digital elevation models. So you start by registering the point cloud, interpolating, removing the curvature across the continuous transect that comes from camera orientation, and then you have the orthophoto and the digital elevation model. Here, you're looking at a 14 by 3 meter lake bed section, and up to 50 centimeter height, and the red and the white corresponds to lows. So these are the different types of bed form that you observe. The so-called pillow hollows, they're large, well-rounded cushions separated by narrow troughs that tend to form continuous channels that could be drainage channel. And you also have this, which has been labeled a quilted cover, which basically looks like a staggered topographic high and lows, but they are separated by saddles that will prevent the existence of connected drainage networks. Then you have sediment wave, which are sort of sub-parallel features, except the troughs are a lot narrower than you would expect for regular sediment waves. This is something that I've called trenches, because the troughs tend to form branching networks, and in between troughs you can either have flatbed or you can have more of those pillow structures. And there's a whole lot of variation between the two, so that's when the trenches are alternating with pillows. That's when the pillows are asymmetric and they have a marked difference between stars and lee side, which strangely doesn't necessarily correspond to the slope of the floor. This pillow depression, which is because the saddles are lower than in the quilted cover bed forms, basically, but you don't have the nice rounded pillows. And you do have isolated craters like that that look like single depression, but that are 10 to 20 centimeter width, so they're not really pock marks. The systematic classification allows to get a distribution map, which is of course sparse because it's limited by the submarine tracks. That's a zoom on in the bay in the north of the lake, close to Lausanne Vili Bay, which is of interest because of sewer treatment, basically. But you do see one thing, which is that the quilted cover bed form are concentrated in the flat part in the center of the lake, and the pillow hollows are more along the slopes. So the idea is that you could start to get an idea of what could be the forcing factors to generate the different bed form types, depending on where they occur. Because of course, what you can do with the 3D models is that first it allows you to get rid of the bias that comes from the viewing perspective, because depending on whether you see those bed forms at a grazing angle or from the top, you can get a whole different perspective. And the extension of the model gives you the morphological context where you find the bed form. So the extension, how long do they remain coherent?
Is that a fish?
That is a fish. We'll come to fish later. And it allows you, for example, to see, because fish is an important player in there, to locate the fish, burbo fish. Relate the fish to the global environment, because you observe a lot of fish in the holes and in the trenches, but you really see like the fish is the size of the entire view frame. So these are four examples of the models that you have. That's the pillar hollows, that's the quilted cover, that's the sediment wave, and that's the trenches. And the idea is now that we have digital elevation models, we can start extracting morphological parameters. So there it's not going to be sinuosity or wavelengths or things like that. It's more going to be how connected those patterns are, basically. Looking at the depth map, for example, and here white is low and dark is high, you can get an idea of how connected the drainage networks are and how uniform your pattern are. You can get an idea of the orientation. So for example, this is fairly isotropic, while this has a clear orientation to it. And this is clearly some kind of network going through the field of view. So again, this a zoom on a depth map to look at the level of connectivity, where here you could do again find a horizontal level where you're gonna cut your topography and decide whether that's a level that will drain the entire network of trenches between the bed forms or not, because it's not clear whether those are relicts, those are active, whether they result from transport that actually will affect the bumps, the highs, or it's just drainage that will incise the trenches. And now, the main idea so far on what causes those structures was indeed the fish, which all the divers in submersibles over time have repeatedly seen this burbo fish that rest in those holes, and when it shuffles its tails, it can resuspend sediment. You can see here, this is very fine grain. It's more silt than clay. It's not very cohesive. So you don't need a lot of energy to resuspend. So at least they play a role in maintaining the holes, in removing sediment continuously. But do they create the landscape or not is another question. In other lakes, in Lake Superior, there's been an observation of biogenic structures which look like trenches, which are represented like that, where the fish hunt, basically. And you do see those in Lake Geneva as well. But these are not the same structures as the bed forms that we were seeing before. Now, what kind of forcing phenomenon could you get? You could get cascading flows, which is when surface water cools rapidly in the shallow parts and will cascade down the slope because it's denser. The flow rate is actually larger than of those cascading events is actually larger than the inflow from the Rhone and other rivers around the lake. You see, so this is a temperature plot, and here as well, this is bottom to the water surface. This is distance across, so from the shore to the deeper parts. And this is distance going west from zero. So you could see that those flow don't go down slope. They also go at an angle to the slope, which if that's what creates the cuspate pillow bed form would make sense because they also have an angle. The asymmetry is at an angle to the slope. And another possible mechanism to produce or to make some energy available on the lake bed, particularly along the slope, is those shore-hugging Kelvin waves that come from the Seiche dynamic when in a stratified condition you have wind forcing that will tilt the pycnocline and the relaxation plus Coriolis forcing will give rise to those Kelvin wave, which you can see here at different locations on the lake. But again, we need to put a camera first to monitor whether those bed form migrates and at which rates, and measure the velocities on different positions. There's very few measurements of currents in the lake available. There's one at the center of the lake in the very middle that shows 10 to 15 centimeters episodically, which would be enough to move sediment around. And that's it.
Thank you. Do we have more questions?
Yes. Can I ask, it's still about the laboratory experiment you showed at the beginning? Because I was just thinking, I'm still confused by the fact that the sediment discharge is the same. The total amount of sediment is transported downstream by the bed form. So I always thought that if you stay with the bed form, then you will see sediment passing. Is it correct or not? So in other way, the sediment velocity is larger than the bed form velocity. Is it correct or not?
So for the coarse grains,
because otherwise it cannot migrate. That's the point. So the sediments are not moving with respect to the bed form. How can the bed migrate downstream? I may be wrong, yeah, but just curious.
So when you do this integration of the flow across surface, which is what this QC product is, you would capture that bed load as well. So whether it's moving with the bed form, it's not like the bulk bed form is moving as a whole and not changing shape. It's that there's grain that are leaving, avalanching down the side, and you capture all of that through your section.
I would say, but I may be wrong, that the sediment transfer rate is just the part that is moving with respect to the bed form. So I would subtract the amount of sediment that moves with the bed form from the total flux of sediment across a fixed section.
to have the,
yeah,
the sediment.
Yeah, if we wanted to measure sediment transport, but here the idea was not to necessarily measure
okay.
sediment
it's
transport.
Just a matter, I'm not saying that is wrong.
Yeah, yeah, you know,
I just mentioned it. For me, the sediment transport part is the part without the amount of sediment moving
yeah.
within the
form.
So it would be interesting to see how all these your measurement scale with that
only
part
with
of
transport.
Sediment transport.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. QC is really not transport as yeah as like bed load transport or it's really like for the coarse grain it's really the what's put in as a control parameter. That's the available sediments.
Okay.
And for the fine grain, it's the available to contribute to the bed forms because the rest just goes as wash load.
For the coarse grains, it's all only, everything is in the dune flux.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is strange to me. I mean, if everything is in the dune flux, how can it propagate?
So it moves, of course, the sediment is moving faster than the bed form.
Okay.
But in the case of the coarse grain, most of the sediment which is moving on the downwind face of the dune is captured by the slip phase. Yeah.
Okay.
So it's the average.
So it just goes this way.
Okay. And of course, there is some transfer of mass between dune, but this transfer is negligible with respect to the to this mass flux. But it's not the case for fine grain because you transport by suspension and it's completely different.
All right, well, there are no more questions. Thanks again.